No. I was born in the States, but I have heritage in Panama. I'm half Panamanian on my mother's side.
All right. Let's see here. All right. Welcome back, ladies and lizard men, to Reptile Ramblings number 12. As always, I'm your host, Nate. And today, as usual, I'm joined by my wonderful, vocally gifted co-host, Mr. Bryant McDowell.
Oh, I thank you so much, Mr. Nate, sir.
And Bryant, how about you introduce the viewers to our guest for the evening?
So we have a grand slam of a guest with Emilio from Animal Encounters. That's his YouTube and overall branding. And we're going to have a smashing episode today as he kind of guides us and talks about some of his neotropical experiences, specifically Panama, but we might indulge in some other topics tonight.
Well, Nate, Ryan, thank you so much for inviting me. And yeah, so happy to be here.
Oh, dude, the pleasure's ours. Glad you could hop on.
Of course.
So before we get too far ahead of ourselves, Bryant, you remember a little pre-game tradition?
I haven't forgotten. Yep.
All right. Well, I've won like the past, what, two times? So I only feels fair that you go this time. It's your guest. So.
That's fine. That's fine. You still want to do rock, paper, scissors? We can do
I want you to go this time.
Okay, so my place of choice would be Jamaica, Jamaica.
Jamaica. All
And
right.
it's funny because it's quite similar to Florida and in terms of invasives over there. And but specifically I would go over there for the boas, for the Jamaican boa, Chilobothrops. I'm losing the species name, but Chilobothrops is the genus name. I mean, gorgeous snakes. And I know they're listed under CITES, what is Schedule Two or something like that. I forget
I
how
think
that
maybe
goes.
one. I could be wrong though.
Is that the higher tier? Because I know you can't really sell
You
them
can't
in the
import them or
States.
anything like that. So
Yeah,
tier one's the
what we
higher one.
have
I
is
know
what we
that.
have. Yeah,
Yeah.
and you can only gift them or whatnot. But I mean, such a beautiful snake. It's like, oh, I would love someday to have them in my collection.
Yeah. But yeah, they have cutus there as well. Plenty of anole
Yep.
species. So
Turtles,
yeah.
frogs abound. Plenty
Yeah.
of stuff to fill your
Very classic.
neotropical belly.
Yeah. Very classic Caribbean herpetofauna.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Caribbean, so that's my choice for tonight. I think a solid outing.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that one. I am a big fan of Chilobothrops as well, so
The superior boa, some might say.
and I would not disagree with them.
Potentially. I would only say maybe Sanzinia would probably be a close second or ahead.
Yeah. Okay, you are right. Sanzinia is pretty high up there as well.
Okay, but before we indulge too much, let's just hop right into it. So, Emilio, so I guess open up to our audiences a little bit and just kind of tell us how you kind of got your start with herpetofauna in general and just the natural world.
Well, truth be told, I can't really tell you when exactly I had to start because it's kind of one of those things where just like as far back as I can remember, I've been doing this. Like
Yeah,
pretty much,
intrinsically.
yeah, since I could walk, talk, run, I've been just picking up. Like when I was little, I started with like lizards and insects and stuff, and then eventually worked my way up to pretty much everything I do now. And it was only like 5 or 6 years ago that I really started like recording stuff that I did, and that's how the YouTube channel came to be, and all the videos and stuff. But I've really been doing this essentially my entire life. So I really love herpetofauna, but I honestly work with everything, any type of animal.
So I guess maybe illustrate the story a bit more because you've had more of an interesting upbringing compared to other guests we've had on. Like you weren't born in the States per se.
No,
Where
no.
then?
It's where I'm currently at right now, which is Ecuador. I am Ecuadorian, but I've moved around quite a bit in my youth. I spent a lot of time in the United States and in the state of Florida, but I also lived for several years in Brazil, a little bit of time in Mexico. And right now I'm going back and forth a lot to your ancestral homeland of Panama, which you know, in recent years I've grown quite fond of. And depending on a few things, I might go back and stay there for a longer amount of time, but that's still to be seen. But I definitely think like living in all these countries had a huge impact on me because I got to experience like a wider array of habitats, species within them. So like I really got to see a massive scope of biodiversity at a really young age. So that's what inspired me. Like, okay, if all this is out there, I want to see even more. Like, how much can I get to see over the course of my life? And that's pretty much what I continue to do.
Yeah, man. And you seem like quite a stand-up guy because you know this is such a privilege to be endowed with and to be able to travel and whatnot. And you know, off air, Nate and I joked about how often you go to Panama, and to the point where you know you're much more of a Panamanian than myself, which is hilarious. You know,
I mean, you gotta get down there at some point, man. You know, if I'm there, I'll show you around.
I do. I mean, I herped a little bit, but that was like back in 21. So I am long due for a revisit and for family. So, you know, I have home bases all around, but, you know,
yeah, I'm kind of saying in a little bit, like I know people in different countries. So like when I go, I'm like, oh, if I hit them up, I might be able to stay here for a little bit, herp around. But yeah, so, dude, if you come to Panama, we've got plenty of spots now that we can go, depending on what you want.
That makes me happy, man. So I'm curious, before we dive into Panama, with Ecuador, just geographically curious, are they divided into, is it departments, provinces, or is it provinces?
So Ecuador is divided into provinces. Of course, it's much smaller country than the United States, but that's like the equivalent to what a state is in the United States. Yeah. But essentially, it's divided more into four regions. That's how we see the divide within the country, which is the Oriente, which is the Amazon, the easternmost part, Sierra, which is the Andes, the middle, that's where the capital is, Costa, the Pacific coast, where the city of Guayaquil, the city I'm currently in and the one I was born in, and then over to the west in the Pacific Ocean, you have the Galapagos Islands, which even though they're much smaller in population, they're their own separate thing, really, like in every sense of the word, but they're still within the country of Ecuador.
Yeah, and you guys have your fair share of UNESCO World Heritage Sites.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, small in territory, but mighty in I guess prowess and.
It is considered a mega diverse country, and also the fact that it's so small is what makes it like really special. Because if you like, there's certain points in the country where if you drive 2 hours in one direction, you're in snow-capped mountains. You drive 2 hours further, you're in the jungle. You drive 2 hours the other way, you're in the Pacific Ocean. Like, you can hit really different parts of the country within days of each other.
So, yeah, I mean, that excites me. Ecuador is one of those countries that's very, very high on my list to visit.
I was fortunate to get to travel a large part of it a few years ago with some of my friends that I think you know, Evan and Harrison Black, the Wildlife Brothers. A few others like Jax from Jax World of Wildlife, Spencer Hoffman, My Wild Backyard, they came to visit me here. And we got to hit up a lot of these places, and they were fascinated by not just the wildlife here, but obviously all that Ecuador has to offer. So yeah, if you can come down here as well, man, that would be amazing.
I mean, there's one area in particular that's well known, you know, Cuyabano. I would love to visit that area.
I've actually never been, so it's on my list too.
No? Okay.
No. I've only been to the Ecuadorian Amazon once, actually.
Now I'm curious. Did you see any anacondas?
No, I wasn't in the area where there are anacondas. However, I have seen anacondas when I was living in Brazil.
Oh, wow.
I went to Manaus twice, and both times I went, I captured green anacondas.
Okay, it's so tough with you because we can indulge in so many different topics, but right off the bat, real quick, why Brazil? What was going on with Brazil?
So I was actually pretty young at the time. I think I was like 12 years old or so. So the reason I moved around a lot when I was young is because of my dad's work. He works in marine insurance, so his company basically had him move around Latin America a lot. So, of course, when I was young, I went with him. And yeah, I was there for about 2 years. So I really got like settled down there. And at that point in my life, I was really heavy into birding more than herping. So like most of the things I did over there were bird related. So like I know more spots for birding than herping, honestly, in Brazil. I honestly wish I'd herped more, but I still got to do a little bit of that, including when I went to the Amazon, got to see the anacondas. And then the other really cool thing that I got to do in the Amazon, well, one of the cool things I got to do that I really enjoyed was in Brazil, they had the pink river dolphins.
Yeah,
and even though they're wild, they basically train them to come and like hang out with people. Like they feed them fish and stuff. So they'll come up to you and you can pet them and everything. And then they'll swim around you. And you're thinking, oh, you're swimming in the Amazon River. What about the piranhas? Well, when the dolphins are around, the piranhas don't come near you. So it's one of the coolest experiences ever.
Yeah, because they are one of the apex predators down there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's.
They're also a lot bigger than you would assume. For a dolphin, they're weirdly shaped. They don't have their dorsal fin. Like their head is really bulbous. Like they look more like, I don't want to like be too crude about it, but like they look like the fetus of a regular dolphin, like expanded. Like that's what it looks like.
Like it's like a great analogy. Yeah.
Bottlenose, like an underdeveloped bottlenose, just grown to huge size.
I always found them very curious creatures, and it wasn't until Jeremy Wade's River Monster series on Animal Planet when he kind of took a different approach. He took a darker, maybe more sinister approach with them because, you know, it's you're in complete darkness, these tan-filled waters in the Amazon. And, you know, you can't really see much, and, you know, they don't really have much eyesight to speak of. And so,
You know, one thing that I found really funny when I was swimming, because there's two rivers that basically form the main Amazon River, and they're different colors. One's darker than the other, but there's a point when they come together where they meet, but they don't mix. So it looks like there's like a glass line dividing the river in half. Like I went to that point, and you can stick your hand in the water and you feel a difference in like temperature and current and everything. It's really weird. But when I went to swim with the dolphins, it was like further up river in the Black River. Over there, the water, like it looks like you're swimming in Coca-Cola. Like that's how best I can describe it to you. Like it's not black per se. It's like an orangey brown color when you're under. Like you can still see, but there's like a weird like sort of tone to it. It's like swimming in Coca-Cola. I don't know how best to put it.
I know what you mean. It kind of plays with the light in a different sense.
Yeah.
But it's like not purely dark like black tea, but it's kind of like Coca-Cola
mix. The other river, the Rio Maranhões, they call it. That one is brown. Like you cannot see anything when you stick your face in there. You see nothing.
So more like hot chocolate versus Coca-Cola.
Yes, that's honestly a very good way to describe it. And then there's a point where you pour hot chocolate and Coca-Cola, and rather than becoming a mixture,
they decapitate. That's what you get.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. The hot chocolate one seems more terrifying to be in.
There's also more bugs in it, anecdotally. Like that's what I can tell. Yeah. So. But that's where the anacondas lie. So it's, you know, sort of pick your poison.
Well, I'm not peeing any of those rivers, so.
Oh, yeah. the famous Candiru.
Candiru.
Yeah. Wouldn't want to. I'd rather find myself, you know, next to a school of piranhas than one of those.
Yeah, because, I mean, piranha is Tucker for a lot of people down there anyway, you know?
Yeah. Like, and they mostly don't really do anything, honestly. Like, they're just over here on my ranch in the West, they're not native, but we do have a lake stocked with a red-bellied paku. They're not true piranhas per se, but they look on the outside superficially very similar. But the weird part about them is if you open their mouth, their teeth, they're human-like.
Yeah.
Like they look like they have dentures on, so.
I forgot the fear, or what's that called for structures like that when it looks too human-like, but they ignite.
Uncanny Valley, is that what you mean? Like.
I think so. I think you might be onto it. But yeah, they do it ignite that in some people. So I can see why when you open up their mouths. Very odd. But yeah, obviously, it's to grind up the nuts and fruits.
I saw it on River Monsters first. And
well, in
life, I'm like, oh, this looks worse than on TV.
Speaking of nuts and fruits, in New Guinea, they do go after a different type of nuts, apparently.
Oh, yeah. I remember that episode, too. Well, listen, I've swam in that lake, and that hasn't happened to me. So let's hope they don't learn from the ones in New Guinea.
Let's hope they don't have a satellite TV in there.
Yeah.
It's funny, you're able to watch the show and then actually go to the places where Jeremy Wade has been and whatnot. That's so cool.
Dude, that is very funny that you mentioned it, because when I was in Manaus, I went to the very fish market that Jeremy always goes to when he does the research before he goes to look for the fish. So it was really crazy. Like, I recognized some of like the places from the show, and like you'd see like the giant like catfish and arapaimas and all that stuff hanging from the walls, and just like massive amounts of other catfish and paku and things. You'd be like, damn, like this is where Jeremy would come like right before all his adventures. So.
Well, it's funny. I think of Jeremy, but then I also think of that one renowned herpetologist, Mark O'Shea, if you've heard of him.
Vaguely familiar, I think.
He's based off the UK. With him,
you know, small flex.
But no, it's a big
I'll
flex.
I'll have to go back and listen to that one for sure.
That's a big flex. But yeah, I mean, he had a show as well, like, even before The Crocodile Hunter, and one of his episodes, wow. You know, I don't know if it was Manaus specifically, but he was in one of those markets where, you know, you see all the dry, dying fish, and like, you right. see aphrodisiacs, which could be a cutoff boa or anaconda tail. What do you call it? Sukuri, and you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, sukuri. Yeah, and
you know, so that's awesome, dude.
I didn't see any of that. I think they're nowadays keeping like a much tighter regulations than what you can sell. Like right now, it's strictly only fish. But I'm sure some sort of back room. If you say the right code word, they'll take you and show you a few more.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the definition of black markets. They always exist, but it's nice to know that they have been a bit more stricter than of
at least like, and you know, at face value, it seems like they're gonna look stricter. So I don't know. Maybe they're just better at hiding it now.
potentially. Okay. Well, you know, I think gone off topic just perfect amount. So now, let's say why? Unless Nate, you had something to dive into.
No, not off the top of my head. I'm guessing you got one question loaded up, ready to go.
We're just going to dive in. So why Panama?
Well, that kind of ties in with the previous answer I gave, where my family moved there a few years ago. So even though I didn't go with them like specifically when they moved, I have been visiting them a lot over the past few years. And now I'm trying to see if I can stay there longer term.
Yeah.
It wasn't originally my choice, but I've gone there now enough times where I'm feeling we're like, okay, this will work.
Started to network enough and kind of be in there enough to know you're starting to feel your groove in that country, which is
especially because it's like a nice middle point.
Mm-hmm.
It literally is a middle point between Ecuador and Florida, which is where I lived most of my life. So. Like I do like, and even culturally, like Panama has a lot of American influence,
but it's still
Latin America. So like the first time I went, even though of course I'd never been since it was the first time, I felt like, oh yeah, this is all familiar. Like this is like, it looks a little bit like Miami mixed with every other South American capital you can think of. Like that's what it was.
It wasn't like that before, you know. I used to go quite a bit when I was younger, and you know, my mother and I have seen the change. It definitely has gotten a bit more Americanized, not for the good, not for the worse, but it is a different beast now. But I think the nice thing about it is becoming a bit more accessible, similar to Costa Rica, even though Costa Rica is still in a league of its own when it comes to ecotourism. But Panama's still playing catch up, but it's getting there.
Yeah, I that's what I talk to a lot of Panamanians about. I'm like, you guys have all the potential biodiversity wise to like compete with Costa Rica, maybe even surpass it, but right now the infrastructure is not there. That's the problem. Like, there's only really one road that cuts across the entire country, like, and a lot of, you know, the weather can be very variable in Central America. So like, if there's a mudslide, that whole entire road gets compromised.
Yeah, but I mean, look at the province like Bocas del Toro. I mean, that is an amazing, amazing province. You know, have you been? I'm curious.
I've never been to Bocas itself. I mean, it's really getting like technical here. Like I went to an island called Escudo de Veraguas, which the island itself is part of that province, but the place where you go to that island, like off the mainland, was still within Veraguas. Mm. It's a little town called Calavera, which the reason I went there is I think I sent you the photo for it, was that island is home to the Panamanian pygmy sloth, which is the smallest and rarest sloth in the entire world. There's only, like, the last census they did in 2012 found only 80 of them. And they're endemic to that island. Like, not even, like, to Bocas, like, just that specific island. That's the only place they live. So, and the other weird thing about it, apart from being half the size of a normal sloth, is that it doesn't live up in the jungle. It lives in the mangroves.
Hmm.
So, to, like, in the video, like, that I did, like, I had to go, like, in waist-deep salt water, like, wading through a mangrove to find it.
Yeah, not the typical habitat.
Imagine a sloth to live in, but that's where they live. And that's what they eat, too. They eat the mangrove leaf.
That's so fascinating. Yeah, this is completely news to my attention. I never knew. When I saw it, it looked like a subspecies. Is it a subspecies of, like, the three-toed?
So it's its own species, apparently. Like, genetically, they've classified it as its own species. But it looks exactly like a three-toed, just half the size.
Yeah.
And living on a mangrove.
Hmm.
So see, that's one of the, like, I told the Panamanians over there, I'm like, This animal should be a symbol of the country, because Panama really has only two animals that are, like, commonly thought of when it comes to conservation. I think you know which ones I'm talking about. One is the harpy eagle.
Okay.
Which, and... you know, that was a big effort from Ron McGill from Miami Zoo. He basically, like, had a huge campaign funded. I think it was Sony, if I'm not mistaken, that, like, helped them fund that. And, like, they basically made, like, a massive awareness, and then Panama has, like, a really healthy population of them now in the Darien jungle. So, like, you go over here in Panama, you go over there and you see, like, tons of, like, buildings and logos and stuff with, like, the harpy eagle, the eagles, everything. So, like, that's one animal that has become a cultural symbol. And I think you know the other, the Panamanian golden frog. That one also, just the same, has become very synonymous with the country of Panama. So that's one where I'm thinking the pygmy sloth could be there among those two. Like, it's an animal that's charismatic enough. It's rare. It's endemic to Panama. Like, and honestly, it doesn't have much time left. Like, if a decade ago there were, or more than a decade ago, there were only 80, who knows how many there are now.
And I mean, yeah, it could follow suit with the Panamanian golden frog, which is a bittersweet icon of Panama.
So that one, I actually did also get to look into it when I was over there. I did an interview with Edgardo Griffith, who runs the EBAC Foundation at Anton Valley, which is one of the breeding centers for the Panamanian golden toad. And, you know, they're doing a really good job at breeding them in captivity. Like, they, I think I don't know how many individuals exactly they managed to rescue, like, when the fungus hit. I think it was in, like, 2009 or so that they saw the last ones there. Yeah, but now they have several thousand just in that facility alone, and I know other places in Panama and other zoos worldwide are breeding them. So the only problem is, like, even though they have a healthy population in captivity, they can't release them yet because the fungus is still out there and they haven't found a cure.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I touch on when it's bittersweet. It's I guess somewhat similar in vein, not really when it comes to the fungi problem, but similar to, like, you know, Chinese alligators. You know, you could breed them as much as you can in captivity. They got healthy numbers in captivity, but
there's just nowhere, you know, to put them,
where to release them, where to take them.
Of the Yangtze Valley is so fully developed, there's nowhere to put a wild crocodilian population there,
and that's where there is a bit of a distinction, because you still have the habitat when it comes to the golden frog. It's just, you know,
fungus isn't there. But here's what's interesting. I this year, like a few months ago, I got to track down another Atalopus, which is the same genus as the golden toad. It was the Limosa harlequin toad. That one is still, there's still a few remaining wild populations. It's also endemic to Panama. I also sent you a photo of that one. It's one that's, like, black.
I saw it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, they're incredible. They're about, like, a third of the size of the golden toad. So they were much smaller than I had originally thought they were.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, like, usually harlequin toads are pretty sizable, but these ones were small.
Yeah.
But that population is now starting to get hit by chytrid. But for some reason, there's some individuals that are seemingly tolerating it. Some are dying, some are not. So, like, I don't know if that's not if that's going to lead to anything, but maybe if we can figure out why those toads are able to deal with the fungus, that might be the clue to, or that might be the answer to dealing with the problem in the golden toads, since they're very similar genetically.
Yeah, that is very odd. It could unlock the key to unlocking, you know, maybe future resistance to chytrid.
The real problem with chytrid, though, is that we really don't know where it came from. Like, the main theory is Africa. But where in Africa? Like, Africa's huge. And then also some people even say that it might have come from Asia. And if we could pinpoint exactly where it's from, we might be able to figure out, like, what evolved alongside it. And therefore, those organisms, like, how are they resistant to it? But, like, if we don't, for as long as we don't know that, it's very hard to, like, figure out how exactly to counteract them. Because I know one thing they try to do is that they did find a bacterium that seemingly, like, killed the fungus, and they tried putting it on the skin of the golden toads, but the bacteria couldn't survive on the golden toads. So for the time being, at least, that project failed. But, like, the cure is honestly going to be something along those lines, if I were to take a guess, like finding some sort of microorganism that can combat the fungus, but also tolerate the skin of the frog, which, as you know, is full of toxins.
Well, I'm curious, isn't it true as well that chytrid doesn't have a high tolerance to heat? I forgot that somewhere.
Yeah, that is true. Like, they require, like, a specific temperature range. But the problem is with climate change, like, it's kind of moving all the temperature gradients.
Yeah.
In South and well, really all of the tropics of the world. So it's kind of been an effect where, like, it's killing stuff here, and then it's killing stuff there, and then it's killing stuff there. So it's just like,
sure.
There's really nowhere to run, essentially.
Yeah, and at the same time, you're dealing with amphibians that maybe they have a temperature threshold as well. But I mean, in captivity, it does seem like they're breeding for that, to have more of a, you know, temperature tolerance.
Yeah, so, like, you can maybe make it too hot for the fungus to exist, but then also the amphibians can't exist either. So,
yeah,
what would be the point at that stage?
That's actually something I've heard about salamanders here in the U.S. is I think it's Salamandivores. It might be a different genus, but it's something similar to chytrid that affects salamanders.
That's really B-Sal, right?
That, you know, it's really done a number on European salamanders. But it doesn't seem to be, well, one, the State Department's actually, you know, completely shut down all salamander imports, for better or for worse, into and out of the United States. So that's probably stopped them from getting in. But also, they found that the temperatures that North American salamanders seem to live at least during the summer, in a matter of a few days, a few weeks, kills off B-Sal. So, and also, North American salamanders might have a bit of a latent immunity to B-Sal. But that's just because Asian and North American salamanders probably closely related to each other.
Yeah. See, the problem is that, like, you normally think of places like Panama being very hot, which is true for the most part, but, like,
the place up in the mountains,
the golden toad was found. Yeah, it's the cloud forest, Anton Valley. So it's not cold per se, but, like, it is cold enough for the virus to survive. So there's actually a few species, not just the golden toad, that have been, like, severely affected by the chytrid virus in Panama, or chytrid fungus, I should say, in Panama. There's another species of Atelopus from the Chiriquí region called Atelopus chiriquiensis that is pretty much all but extinct at this point. Like, I think the last one they saw were in the 90s, and there's none in captivity. There's another frog that I'm blanking on the name right now, that was from Anton Valley, which the last surviving one was in the botanical gardens over in Atlanta. His name was Tuffy, and he died in 2012. I think it was like Rab's fringed limb frog or something like that. So they were from Anton Valley as well. And I think they were found only a few, like, they were discovered only a few years before the fungus came and wiped them out. So unfortunately, they didn't have the head start the golden toad had with the breeding program.
You know, Panama has so much cool crap, and it's just so overlooked and overshadowed by, you know, the other countries and whatnot, that you don't get to know. You don't know. So Nate now is showing us one of the antelope species.
I finally got the photos working.
Thank you, mate. Thank you. Oh, see, it's a beautiful frog.
Yeah, yeah.
Those, yeah, those, I would have thought it'd been a bit bigger for sure, because their proportions make it look like they seem a bit bigger.
Yeah, I had only seen them in photos before, so like they're like a third about the size of a golden toad, and they really look out of place in the jungle. Like the first one I saw was like we were going to the stream where they live. Like if you see photos of them, they usually like sit on rocks, like these pristine, clear streams. And it's like beautiful. But some of them do go like deeper in the forest floor. So like when I saw it, it looks like those like toy like rubber plastic frogs that you buy at at a Halloween store. And I just saw it sitting on the floor, and I'm like, that looks really out of place here. Like that doesn't look real. It looks like someone like just planted it there to try to trick me. But then it hopped, and I'm like, oh no, that's real. That's actually an Atelocus.
Did you see any male, I guess, hand waving display that they do?
No, I didn't get to see any of that. But what I did get to see is that most of the, like, we saw 11 individuals that day, and 8 of them were like tiny juveniles.
Okay, that's good. So recruitment.
It shows that they're still breeding. Like that's mm-hmm. like maybe I was like, that shows that I was a little bit past the breeding season, which is why I wasn't seeing too many adults or too many like behavioral displays. But there were a lot of juveniles running around or hopping around.
Well, it's always good to see recruitment.
Yeah, yeah.
For a threatened species is awesome.
We did find a dead one though, unfortunately. That's what like freaked me out a little bit. And we sent it to a herpetologist over there, and he confirmed that it had chytrid on it, but they're running tests on it. Okay.
I guess with this adventure with the antelopes, let's go back. So you weren't by yourself. Who did you tag along with?
So there I was actually with Spencer Hoffman from Mile Wild Backyard. He's a good friend of mine, and he was over there mainly looking for spiders, but we also like did this kind of the side quest to look for the antelopes as well. We found plenty of spiders too, so that was also a really interesting day, or night, I should say.
You know, it's funny when you have a target species or genera in general, it's always great to have somebody else that's interested in the natural world, but in a completely different, you know, class, and somehow it tends to work out that you get to see,
especially in the tropics.
Oh yeah,
you find like everything there. But like he was interested in the frog too, though. Like he wanted the frog as well.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But
and, you know, with the neotropics, you know, what's funny is biodiversity and whatnot and numbers are amazing, but when it comes to quantity, that tends to dip compared to the states, at least anecdotally from my small experience doing that.
Yeah, I would say you're right. And in most cases, like when I was living in Florida, like the most common way to herp, and I think in a lot of the United States it's the same too, is road cruising.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm sure most of the listeners know what that is, but for those who don't, like you basically just hop in your car, just drive around a road for hours hoping that there's a snake or whatever you're looking for on the road. And in Florida, there would be nights where I would be getting like in the dozens of snakes. But usually they were like the same 5 or 6 species that kept repeating, and occasionally one more would be thrown in the mix. But I don't think I've ever found that many snakes in a single night in the tropics ever. Because A, I'm not road cruising, I'm hiking, so I'm covering a lot less distance. And then B, just there's not that much volume out there, but usually every snake I find is a different species. So I could get 5 or 6 species while only finding 5 or 6 individuals. And I find a lot more other stuff too.
Yeah, it's an interesting trade-off. But also Florida, and especially South Florida, I would think that is your closest way to somewhat experience neotropical herping, just because, you know, in a sense.
Yeah, in a sense, it is. But like for me specifically, I spend a lot of times in the Everglades, and the Everglades, like it's nothing like the jungle at all. Like this is open marshland, grassland, sawgrass. Sawgrass is what you call it. There's places where there's not a single tree in sight, so you're just looking down the entire time. Whereas in the cloud forest, for example, you have to be looking 360 at all times. Like there's stuff in every direction.
Yeah. That is a good point.
I'm not a huge fan of road cruising per se. Like I kind of zoned out after a few hours of just looking straight down a road.
Oh, it gets so tedious, dude. Yes.
Yeah, like when you're with people, it can be pretty fun. But like if you're alone, like, and it's late at night, it can be a little bit brutal. But hiking always keeps you on your toes when you're out here. Every sound you hear, every leaf that drops, you're like, what was that?
Yeah, you're more in the zone. You're more intrinsically just with it all. You know, have to be. You know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I obviously have the least amount of jungle hiking experience out of the three of us, but I can tell you, if you turn your lights off in the middle of the jungle at night, it's dark. It's dark, dark.
I've done that voluntarily and involuntarily before. Voluntarily, it's pretty peaceful. You get to see the stars and stuff, and like it's pretty nice. But when it happens involuntarily, it's scary.
Yeah, your lights go out. You're like, I don't believe in the boogeyman, but
the only thought that's running through my mind at that point is, please tell me I packed a spare. I'm sure I could not have forgotten that other flashlight. And luckily, that hasn't happened. But
yeah,
what about bugs? Yeah. How do you deal with bugs?
So the funny thing is that there's some parts of Latin America where you barely have any bugs to deal with. Like, it seems weird, but that's why I like the cloud forest a lot. Like, there's not really any mosquitoes there, at least in some parts of it. Like,
which is almost oxymoronic because, you know, the atmosphere is quite humid. Or, I mean, in some cases, it can be quite humid. And you would think it'd be perfect breeding grounds for mosquitoes.
But it's usually too cold for them. That's the thing.
That's the key.
So the cloud forest is one place where, in most cases, I walk around, with no bug spray or with no long sleeves or anything. I walk out without a single bite. Whereas in Florida, for example, if you go to the Everglades that night in the summer, you will get slaughtered. So, it was at the end of February. So a few weeks ago. Yeah. I briefly went over to that inn. That was pretty much the last week I was in Panama. It wasn't for herping per se. I was going with a friend who was going to inspect the property. But over there, in Panama, I hadn't experienced very bad bugs in most places that I had gone to. That inn is a different story. That jungle is just filled to the brim with insects.
Okay.
They will skin you alive out there.
I believe it because, I mean, it mainly consists of still primary rainforest, isn't it?
Yeah, very. The other thing, it's not just that it's primary, but it's very swampy. Like, the ground itself is wet. You touch it, and it's wet. Like perma wet. Yeah, exactly. It's just constant. It's just mud. It's not really for example, if you look at most of the jungles out here, there's a dense layer of leaf cover, then there's a bit of organic matter, and then you do hit the rock. But over there, it's just kind of swamp.
Yeah.
So
it's just a very thick layer of eons of decomposed organic material, just soaking up water.
Peat moss, basically.
Yeah. So, I didn't really get to see much herp wise. Again, it wasn't a herping trip, but I can tell you, the next time I go, when I go more for a wildlife focused mission, I will be much more prepared.
Still, you see some amphibians or lizards.
I really didn't see much on it because, again, I didn't get much of a chance to herp, but the only snake I found was a common blunthead, which those I see around Panama City all the time. So
is that really, is that the same as cloudy? No, not my bad. My sail eaters make them all have bluntheads. Rookie mistake, I know.
Imantoles senchoa, I believe, is the
sign. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, same species song, Costa Rica.
Those are vine snakes, which are the oxybellies. Those are the most common snake I find around the capital. They're also very long and thin, but the blunt heads, they have the weirdest body shape in my opinion. It's just a very thin ring and then just a ball for the head.
Yeah. It's like a light bulb on the end of a extension cord.
Yeah, that's what it is.
It's so odd. So maybe my bad, Nate. Maybe you can compare and contrast. When you hold a vine snake, it feels like it barely grips onto you, as opposed to a blunt-headed. Again, they're both quite small snakes diameter wise, but feels like the Imantores at least holds onto you a bit more so than the the vine snakes. And you know, you're making all of the all of Arizona herpers jealous by saying vine snakes being the most common snake of your travels there.
I didn't know this was a thing until honestly I saw Smet Logic's journey to get the his vine snake in Arizona, and I'm like, wait a minute, those are rare in the States? Like, honestly, they I know it's a different species, but they look very similar to the ones you have in the States. Like, there's like the green species, and then there's like the brown ones. Yeah. Like, I most commonly see the brown ones in Panama, but they look very similar to the ones in Arizona. But like, to the point where if you come to Panama and we go to a specific spot of mine, I can guarantee you like multiple vine snakes on that run.
Like, I know we might exactly have to organize something in the next couple of years.
For sure. Yeah.
Dude, well, they're great snakes. And, like, and I've seen that spot,
I can guarantee you two herps, which is the vine snake and the green and black poison frog. Like, those are two things that if we go, we're going to find for sure.
I'll be sure to pack my camera then.
yeah, and that's, before we get... that place is actually within the city, so.
Okay.
I think I know the area.
I think you know the area then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before we get too far along, Joy in the chat was asking if you've ever seen a black caiman in any of your travels.
No, that's actually one of my target species for the next few years. Like, that's like, black caiman is like very, very close to the top of the animals I want to film next. But I have caught the spectacled caiman before. Like, those are guys that, in fact, currently on the ranch, we have one that's like kind of swimming around the lake. So I don't know if I'll go after him in a few days or not, but we'll see.
It's so cool to have a caiman as a local, like, as you know, people in Georgia and Florida has, you know, gators. Canals. That's funny.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
Honestly, it might be a little bit preferable to a gator because they're just so much smaller.
Well, what I will tell you is we also have American crocs in Ecuador, like, not precisely in there, they live nearby
down the coast. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Like, they're here too.
Isn't that the most southerly they get too? Is in Ecuador. I think
they technically like bleed into like the very northern tip of Peru, but like, it's basically around here. It's like the southernmost you get.
I wonder what stops them from going further down. Maybe, I guess, latitude wise and temperature.
Take a guess.
Temperature.
I was gonna say, if I had to take a guess, it's the fact that the Pacific coast of the Americas has the cold upwelling currents.
Yeah,
and also it's right on the Andes Mountains, so there's not a huge amount of lowland wetlands for them to live in,
right? Because the habitat that's like, or was, that's mostly been developed at this point, but like the habitat that's originally native to this area that I live in Ecuador, in the Guayaquil zone, is the coastal dry forest, which, you know, for most of the year is like the ground is cracked and it's brown or yellow vegetation, but like right now when it rains, it rains, like everything instantly turns green, like all the water levels rise by like 3 or 4 meters, like just flooding everywhere. But if you go just a little bit south into like that very southern tip of Ecuador, or all of Peru, it's a desert pretty much. Completely dry. It rarely ever rains down there. So that definitely has something to do with it, I would assume.
You know, I think some people wouldn't get the concept of it, you know, still being a rainforest, but dry, the dry element. I think people would just think it's always kind of permanently raining or not raining and still
just humid. A little bit north of here is we have the Choco, which is like, it's another very wet biodiverse rainforest, which I've only been to a handful of times, but like that area is wet year round. So it's really
is interesting. Is that on is that on the other side of the Andes?
It's on our side. It's on the Pacific side.
Okay. It's like further north or south there?
Further north. Yeah. Yeah. So like a little bit further north, you have permanently wet. A little bit further south, you have permanently dry. But here, it's like wet dry.
Mm.
Like, we're in the transition zone per se.
I got in the Goldilocks zone.
sort of. I would prefer it would be a little bit wetter longer because like we have most of the year dry. But
okay, so being this kind of transitional habitat, have you noticed a big any difference or unique admixture of herpetofauna in this seasonal forest versus the more northern tropical forest and the more southern dry areas?
Yeah, I would say so for sure. Like, one example would be the crocodiles, like that you mentioned. Like, it is interesting to see that like they do bleed into here and they don't go much further south because of the desert. But then what else can I think of? Like, there's definitely a lot of amphibians that won't be able to go much further south because they do depend on having to be to be a little bit wetter conditions for them to be able to breed. Like, right, there's a lot of amphibian species where I don't know where they're at for most of the year. Like right now I'm seeing them out and about because there's so much water everywhere, but like they got to be deep underground like 6 months from now.
So yeah,
that's what I assume that they're doing.
We kind of had a weird inverse, me and Bryant, up here in the Midwest, where it's, you know, thawing out, first bit of solid warm weather we've had all year, and just now we're seeing amphibians come out after what's really one of the coldest winters we've had in a while. And it's like, where do you guys go to get below the frost line? Because the frost line, especially this winter, has gone way down into the ground. So where do you go well, wood frogs, obviously, you just, you know, tank
also, it. Also, a little bit outside of the herpetofauna, what where the difference is really like, or the admixture is really shown, I would say, is in the birds. You do get like a very interesting mixture of migratory birds. Like you have got all like the coastal, like shore birds, but also mixed with some of like the more jungle ones. Like there is a very interesting, like that's, I think it's the category in which you can most easily observe that transition zone when it comes to animals. Like the birds is, I think, is the best example. But yeah, in the herpetofauna, as you were mentioning as well. And then, the other interesting animal that like we have around here is there's a type of snail eating snake. That one is in the genus Dipsis. I can send you the photo for it. I don't think I sent it to you on the original batch. But one question that a friend of mine and I have been like trying to figure out for years, we haven't really put too much work into it yet, but like we've just kind of like been, you know, shooting around with it, is like, if they're snail eaters and the snails are not around for most of the year, what do they eat for the rest of the year? Like,
yeah, right.
Because they're, I've found them in the dry, in fact, I find them a lot in the dry season. And I've never been able to like really pinpoint exactly what they're eating, but I'm like, but you don't see snails at all. Like unless they're going underground and getting them, like you don't really see snails out during the dry season, but those snakes are there. So
could it be not, when you're finding them, are they like out roaming around or you just seem like coiled up somewhere? Cause if it's during the dry season, maybe it's just, they don't have as much cover to hide in. That makes it easier to spot.
So the thing is, like, here specifically, during the dry season, where I think most of the snakes go, considering I found some of them in there, is that, like, the ground starts to, like, crack, and it forms, like, these, like, very deep, like, fissure. And I think all the animals just, like, go in there. So when you come down here during the dry season, like, it's actually very hard to herp. But one of the few snakes I do find still in dry season tend to be these snail eaters. I've seen them go in and out of the cracks.
You know, that's odd. The only thing I can relate to it was in my time in Oaxaca, since I've been in the dry season and a little bit in the wet season now. And, you know, there's snail eating specific snakes over there as well. And even in the dry season, I would see, you know, I guess, semi-drought adapted snail species. I guess, you know, do you have, you know, drought resistant snails where you're at? Could that be the case? Few and far between, but still there's a food source.
Yeah, it could be the case. And I know like snail eating snakes don't specifically only eat snails. Like I know they go for slugs as well. Some of them even specialize in frog eggs in certain areas. Like I know that's the case too, but I don't think that's the full explanation. Like I'm kind of burying the lead a little bit here, but one of my theories that I have, which kind of happened by accident, was that in the same night I found a cat-eyed snake and a snail eating snake, the cat-eyed being pretty small compared to the snail eater. And not thinking too much about it, I put them in like the same holding tank to take a picture of them the next day. When I came back, the cat-eyed was gone and the snail eating was fat. I can't confirm what happened, but I have a strong suspicion.
Can't confirm, but
yeah. So the species of snail eater, is that Nebulata in?
No, at least in my area, it's Dipsis georgetti.
Okay.
It's an endemic one.
Okay. So we say that maybe that particular species of snail eater might be a little bit more generalist than other more specialized species.
Yeah, that definitely could be the case. I've seen Nebulata in Panama of all places. So,
you know, that's so funny you bring that up with the Dipsis, I guess, potentially predating on the Lepidoptera. When quite a few episodes back, I brought to Nate's attention there was a hurt note of a cat-eyed snake predating on a Dipsis. So it's funny that I guess it could go both ways.
They might be at war with each other.
Apparently, even though I think Leptodera, I think it's the more diverse genus, no, I mean, they're everywhere from Mexico.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They go
to the neotropics.
A lot wider. Yeah, yeah.
I guess that bleeds into my next question. What would be more common for you to see? Snail eaters or cat-eyed?
Definitely cat-eyed. Cat-eyed's like funnily enough, on this return to Ecuador, I have yet to see a single snail eater, but I find a cat-eyed every other night.
Okay. Like that's how it was for me in Panama. That's how it was.
Cat-eyes are the second most common snake I find on the ranch. Like I actually didn't, like, I think it was just because I didn't know how to look for them. I didn't start finding dipsis until like 3 or 4 years ago. Man. When I found the first one, like it's one of those things where like you find one and all of a sudden you start finding them at all the time.
The but door is open that for you.
First find, yeah. I couldn't find any.
It's like, oh, I understand it now. Yeah.
I you unlocked in. This character.
So with dipsis, what's the difference in herping that you've noticed? How do you find dipsis differently than other snakes, I should say?
So with dipsis, like in Panama, for example, like they're usually going to be sitting like a meter or two above the ground on a leaf. They're kind of going to be coiled. So I knew that dipsis were in the area and that's how I would look for them. But I was just like, oh, they're probably just not in this specific part of the property. Like I haven't seen any. But then I started finding them, like I mentioned before, on the ground. That's where I normally see them. Like I'll be walking and it'll look like you're seeing like any other ground dwelling snake, but you get close to it and you see a dipsis, which that hasn't been my experience with any other of the dipsis I've seen. I've seen a couple others like Nebula, or well, that's Simon, but dipsis, I think it was the elegant one or the one of them, one of the Andean ones I saw when I was over in the cloud forest. Those who follow the rule of tending to be like coiled up, but these guys live on the ground. So now that I started noticing that, I'm like, okay, if I want to look for them, I'll keep an eye out for them on the ground.
Okay. Also in the chat, Joy was saying, if you want to find black caiman in Ecuador, the place to go is Yasuni National Park.
I've been there. I've been That's to Yasuni.
Said, huge. He says apparently there's some big ones out there. They estimate like 5.5 meter range. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, I've been there. I just wasn't specifically going for them, but Cuyabeno is also like a very good place for them as well. Like, so Cuyabeno is definitely.
I mean, they're both.
The problem with Yasuni, though, I will tell you, is that everything's super protected over there. So like, there's a very limited amount of things you can do with them, because it is a national park.
This is true. I mean, and then they do have, you know, I guess, eco lodges around the property and whatnot. So
So I mean, you can, it's kind of just like, hasn't been for like I wouldn't say not that it's a lack of trying, but I just haven't like given it priority. But that's something I'm gonna get around to at some point. But definitely black caiman was I think it might be like at least 2 or 3 like overall for me right now in terms of like Latin American herps that I want. What used to be the front runner for years, funnily enough, was the Fertilance. For like most of my life, that was the snake I wanted the most. And it was just one of those bad luck things where like I just couldn't find any. And then when I finally got one, and I found it in the most unlikely of all places. It was in the cloud forest, like 1600 meters above elevation. That's like the very, that's the one. That's the very one, like that's my lifer essentially. It was
a good lifer, man.
It's 1600 meters above elevation when like they're much more common like here, but I couldn't find any here. And then one day in the cloud forest, I find one. I'm like, oh, okay, this works.
Well, you know, they're one of the weirdest snakes, you know, I've seen as well, is that sometimes they can be quite arboreal, being very high up
the
tree, which is just so odd for being a relatively heavy bodied viper.
The other thing that they do that I find really weird is that they behave very cottonmouth-like. Like, they'll go on the water and just, like, swim on the surface and, like, to the point where, like, they'll coil up on the surface. They're not even swimming anymore. Like, they'll coil up and start rattling their tail. Like, that's happened to me a couple times before.
That's really great to know. Yeah, because, you know, there are similarities the more you speak about it with them and cottonmouths. These are just, you know, obviously way more dangerous than potentially life-threatening.
And not just the snake itself, but also the place you're in. Like, if you're in cottonmouth territory, you're most likely within driving distance of a hospital that has antivenom. If you're in Fertilance territory, that's not at all a guarantee.
Not the same case, no. But they're beautiful. What is this, Asper or Aatrox you guys have?
We have Asper. Yeah, it's the same one in Panama. In Panama, also, I have a place where it's not 100% guaranteed, but like during the right time of year, it's at least likely that we can get Fertilance. Last year, another good friend of mine, I'm not sure if you know him, Christian Cave from Caveman Wildlife, he was in Panama. And we went to this place and we found a like 5.5, almost 6 foot Fertilance just like coiled up on the road. And in my experience, every Fertilance I had found before that had been really calm, just sat still as long as you didn't move them. That one was just, you know, on 11, like it was just like, it was sitting still at first. And then it just went like, boom, just like jumped out at me and was just running, like just slithering around and striking.
It kind of lived up to its Thirsty Old Fellow reputation. And yeah,
like it caught me off guard because at this point in time, I had already gotten many Fertilances before that. Like there had been years between my lifer and that one. And then every other one had been very placid, chill, easy to work with, almost to the point where I'm like, okay, every single thing I've heard about the Fertilance is a complete myth. Like they're super easy to work with. And then that one just completely just, I'm like, okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I have been lulled to a false sense of security.
Yeah.
He was lulled. That's fine.
Yeah,
that's
lulled because I gave my hook to Christian. So I only had a flashlight in my hand. So when it jumped at me, I had nothing to work with. So I'm like, Christian, come get him.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely use the tongs on that individual for sure. They're beautiful. You know, I guess the other common name is what? Barba Maria? Just because, you know, yellow.
They have a lot of common names. Like
they do. Equis.
In Honduras, they call him Barba Maria. I think they call him like Nauyaka or something in Mexico. Yeah, but Mexico, in Panama, yeah, and in Ecuador, we call them Equis.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like the X snake because of the patterns on its back.
Mm-hmm. No, so, yeah, beautiful viper.
And then right after I finish with the Equis, I'm like, okay, what's next? And the only logical like next step for me was the Bushmaster. But I'm like, oh, the Bushmaster, that one's so much harder than the Fertilance. And it took me that long to hit the Fertilance. This is probably gonna be like a massive like I didn't have too much high of hopes. First trip to Panama, first time in Anton Valley, first night there. I go out and we were looking for eyelash vipers, which was another target of mine at the time. Found the eyelash vipers. And the guy I was with, he gets a call and he tells me, he's like, hey, by the way, there's a local property nearby that say they saw a Bushmaster hanging around some, like, I think it was like a tool shed or something. And they want me to come look for it next morning. You want to come? And I'm like, yes. So then we went and then we found the Bushmaster. So like,
no way. Wow.
One of those crazy things where like the common snake took me years to find, and then the Bushmaster, the really rare one, took me one attempt.
Wow.
So it's just one of those things when it comes to herping. Like you can't really predict.
No, you cannot. You
put into it to get an animal.
Mm. I mean, they're such a magnificent snake too. I mean, and they're another one with a lot of common names.
Oh yeah, like they call him like Berruosa, where I'm from, and in Panama, but in other places they call him Matawey, which means the ox killer. Matawey. Like Bushmaster is a scary name. Ox killer is even more, in my opinion.
But I would say they're far less deserving of maybe their brutal reputation. They seem to have much more of a calm demeanor than
I mean, I only have worked with one, but that one also, like the first Fertilance I worked with, like much easier than I expected.
Yeah,
but what surprised me about it is that it felt different than every other snake I'd worked with. I mean, to be fair, the Fertilance as well, like they get the name Terciopelo because their skin is very velvety. So the first one I tailed it and like I felt it. I'm like, oh, this does feel like velvet.
Huh.
Like, it was very strange. But then the Bushmaster, it feels like you're holding like a tegu or some sort of other bearded lizard. Like the scales are very big, very circular.
They're like bumpy, beaded. Like yeah.
So yeah, that's the Bushmaster we got at Anton Valley as well.
Wow.
So
you saying it is beautiful? Were you saying you went to the Serpentarium that's there in Valle de Anton?
Yeah. So we went to the Serpentarium. So the guy who owns it, his name is Mario Rioja. Shout out to him as well. He also runs herping tours down there. So like, I asked him like, hey, do you think we could go like on a guided like walk to go look for the eyelash vipers? So originally I asked him about the Bushmaster, but he's like, don't even try. Like, you're not going to find it. I'm like, okay, can we go for the eyelash vipers? He's like, yeah, well, we should be able to find them. So like we went there, and originally we were actually finding another snake called Cybin Argus. Like, it was a snail eater that looks exactly like, almost exactly like an eyelash viper. So, like, they mimic the appearance to the point where, like, we saw, like, six of them, I think. I'm like, oh, eyelash, no, snail eater. Eyelash, snail eater. And then when the seventh snake showed up, I'm like, oh, it's a snail eater. As soon as I said that, it turned its head and I saw the little horns and I'm like, oh, now it's an eyelash. That wasn't the one from that first night, but that's so the interesting thing about eyelash vipers is that they're very variable in their color. Like, there are some snakes that have like morphs of like the patterns a little bit, like they shift, but eyelash vipers just straight up change color, like between individuals. Like, you have bright yellow like that one, you have some that are green, some that are red, some that are like almost blue. I'm not sure why the species is so variable. I mean, and it's not even just a geographic thing. Like, within the same locality, you'll have individuals of different colors. So,
yep. I can tell you from my trip to, Costa Rica, on one property, we saw a couple different eyelashes, several different color variations on the same property. So,
yeah. I still have yet to see like an explanation as to why the color varies so much, but it's really fascinating. Like the first one I found was the Christmas tree variation, which is like mostly green with a little bit of red. But that one, like, is, they call it the Oropel, which is the golden face. So that one was also in Panama as well.
Yeah. I think I am a sucker for the golden one and the Christmas. I think those are my two favorite phenotypes for sure.
I mean, the next one I would like to see, if I ever get the chance, I want to see the red one.
Forgot about those.
I think in Bocas is the place where they have them. So, like, we'll see if I get a chance at one of those.
Are they still super ciliaris in Panama, or are they?
No. I know they divided them up. That's another can of worms we can get into. They recently split them, but some people don't really accept the split. So there's kind of a debate going on right now as to what they really are. Like, they're right now, if we're going by the new split, the species that we have in most of Panama is Nigro aspersus.
Yeah.
I can't say it, so.
Supercellaris is like at the very west of Panama. It like bleeds over a little bit. They're mostly in Costa Rica, but we do have like a little bit of them in Panama. And then there's one that like crosses over into the Darien. I forgot what the name was off the top of my head. But if we go by the new split,
it was a big deal. There was like, what, four or five? They divided them up quite a bit.
Like, they split Nigro aspersus into like 10, I think.
Never mind.
I think there's like five new ones in Colombia, three new ones in Ecuador, like two new ones, something like that, something crazy like that.
This might be worse than our Pantherophis situation.
It just might be, honestly, because some are saying like, no, it should still all be one species. Some are saying, okay, the divide should only be between central and south. Some are saying split them even more. So I'm like, okay, I don't know. I'll leave it to them.
Yeah.
But what is interesting is that some of them, like, it's not just the color that changes, but there are some, like the ones we have here in Ecuador, that straight up don't have the eyelashes. So I feel like those probably warrant a designation as a different species, because they're not even eyelash vipers anymore.
No, they're just your typical, like, what, Southern Asia shore viper or something like that.
The blotched side stripe, or the, because we have other Bothrycus in Panama as well.
Yes.
Like, we have the black and green palm viper and the side stripe, I think it's called.
Well, you have a bilineatus?
I think
there's also that bilineatus
we have here in Ecuador, I think.
Is it also Arifer?
And then lateralis we have in Panama, and we also have Nigro viridis. I think those are the ones we have. Like, I think we have, I mean, for sure we have at least four, five, depending on if you count the new eyelash viper. At least within that genus, but in total, like, Panama, like you mentioned, I think it has a very underrated like biodiversity. It's just, to find a lot of these animals, like, the places are not as accessible in Costa Rica. So in Costa Rica, to get some of the snakes you guys would want, you can easily just pull up to like a 5-star resort and like they're around the property. For the time being in Panama, most of these places you have to camp out 3 days in a mountain if you want to see a rare snake.
Accessibility is definitely one thing that Panama's lacking for sure.
Yeah. But they're getting there. They're getting there. I've seen progress in the short time I've been there.
But I mean, they are very diverse, viper-wise. I'm just curious, do you have more of a affinity for vipers and venomous, or is it all the same to you when it comes to at least snakes specifically?
I mean, there's definitely like a wow factor when it comes to the venomous snakes, only because like you know you can't make a mistake. Like you know you have to be on your game. You can't, you know, overextend yourself or get too confident. At the same time, you can't be too worried because that also still makes you prone to mistakes. So you have to be at like a very like calm center. Whereas with other snakes, you can kind of take the liberty where like, oh, I know this thing's not going to kill me. I mean, if I get bit, it doesn't matter. So you get a little bit sloppier. Sometimes you get tagged a little.
Yeah, but then you have coralillos, and those are kind of different ballparks because they can be quite spasticky.
Yeah, those are pretty spazzy. And then I mean, you got to really make sure you know what you're working with at that point. Because you don't want to be saying like, oh, this is a false one. And then it wasn't a false one.
Yeah. But what about, so I'm curious, have you seen any corals in Panama and some of your trials? Yeah.
Not in Panama yet, but here in Ecuador, I have found both true and false corals. I think I sent you the picture of the false one, if I'm not mistaken.
Is that Yithrolamprus or?
No, that's Lampropeltis.
Or milk. Okay, Lampropeltis, okay. Because, I mean, there's quite a few genera that, you know, mimic.
Yeah, there's a few that, like, take up that tricolor pattern. We do have Erythrolampus here that is also a false coral, but I just haven't seen it.
Okay.
Yeah, that looks like a lamp.
Yeah, that's the one. You know what surprised me is I've worked with lamps in the States, and they're all very calm over there, but this one was very nippy.
I've had my share of nippy milk snakes, to be honest, but man, that looks like a brute. I mean, it looks dense.
He looks, it looks solidly built.
It was almost 4 feet.
Oof. Is this Balaizona? I think it is. They don't really divide.
They call it the Ecuadorian milk snake, but you know, these guys, like, when I mean nippy, I mean like it wasn't doing the typical like I'll bite you and just like oh, and like it would bite me and then just start chewing.
Yeah,
like it's one of those guys. I'm like, oh great.
That reminds me of one of my California kings I used to have, that she would just randomly, you hold her and you just start to see her rubber side of her face against you, like oh here it comes. She just latch on, and you're like, well, guess I gotta hold my hand underneath the sink for 10 minutes now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, has Lampropeltis been, what would you say, in a category of relatively common or uncommon for you?
Oh, and that's the only one I found so far here. Like,
okay.
Not that I've looked for them specifically, but like,
sure.
Like they're, I mean, that's the only species we have in the area of Lampropeltis. So, but I have seen more of them in the States.
Well, I'm curious, would you introduce the concept of flipping, like laying down tin or wood?
You know, I've tried, but the problem is that like out here,
too wet.
It's too wet. It's too wet. And like to the point where like stuff will literally like, that's why, like, I know in the States, like, and it's very common for like when people are out herping, like they'll tell you like, oh, you have to put everything back. Like you have to try to like leave everything untouched. There's like micro habitats and stuff. Dude, everything I move here is gonna be completely out of place the next time I come. Like the water is just gonna move everything around, every tree, everything's gonna be. So if I lay out a board, it's not gonna be there the next time I'm here.
It's a different ball.
Someone moved it, or the water moved it. So,
yeah.
Speaking of which, what I will say is, like, I do take advantage of like existing like wood stacks and, you know, garbage lying around, and I have found stuff in there.
Okay.
But it's hard to like specifically lay things out with reptiles being there in mind.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a bit more of a temperate and slash, you know, it just depends how your water table is and whatever sort of area when it comes to laying down material.
Yeah. Speaking of that, Brian, I actually just today got a pile of scrap tin. So I'm going to be talking to my high school biology teacher. He has a property near where really? I live. See if I can lay out a little tin line on his like 20 acres of woods.
Oh, dude, get the circular saw going. Make it multiples. You know,
more. I have like probably 10, maybe a dozen pieces of tin. Most are like 7 foot range, like 7 by 4 foot. So,
well, that's what I'm saying, dude. Divvy them up. You know, they don't need to be that big. Just cut them up, and then you'll have like 28, even more.
Yeah, make it a little easier to transport into the woods as well.
That too. That's good. Yeah, I mean, that's why I brought it up, Emilio, just because I've set up a few sites for, you know, Lampropeltis and other species, and it's a fantastic way to survey for sure. You know, I know you could also implement it, I would say, in many areas in Mexico, and then just depending where you are in Central America, it really is just all depending on how well do you know your area and
yeah
and everything.
You know, I haven't tried it in Panama. That might be worth giving it a shot at some point.
I mean, who knows? I mean, what about in Florida? You say you did a lot of road cruising in Florida, but also hiking as well?
Somewhat, yeah. I mostly did road cruising while I was over there. I did hike a little bit in the Glades sometimes, but I found at least road cruising was just more effective. And then also, you know, Florida is also not an easy place to herp, just because like a lot of it is like either private land or protected, and you kind of have to know where you are. And if someone who's not from there doesn't really like, it's really hard even to like know people in Florida who like know their way. Like they're not very open over there to showing you around per se, but I mean, I get it. That's how the place is, but
man, you're not taking my Jackson chameleons off of me. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even trying to take them. I just want to see them.
Yeah, they don't.
You know how hard I worked. You know how hard I worked for these redheaded gamas. I'm keeping this place secret. Yeah. Granted, it's just some bridge right next to the hood, so not really worth keeping it a secret. But
yeah, you're not protecting endangered species. Most of the things that are out there are just like not even supposed to be there. So, like, why people safeguard it so tightly, I don't fully understand. But that's just how it is.
I mean, if you had like an indigo spot, I could understand you want to keep that locked down. But if you're like our examples, agamas or nightingales or basilisk or something like that, it's like
hard to tell. Yeah,
chameleons is the big one I've found. Like it took me years to get a chameleon spot in Florida. Like no one wanted.
Shot at. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's also the thing is there's a commercial interest in keeping people from finding them.
Yeah. Like to get a spot where I wouldn't be shot at, because I had a spot where I would have been, so I didn't go. So like, they told me, I was like, hey, you can go here, but you'll get shot. I'm like, okay, then I won't go.
It's not really a spot then, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So by the time I got that, like, I did manage to get like an actual one, but the one that I still need, if anyone's willing to, you know, hit me up, is Panther Chameleon. That one I never got while I was over there, so.
Really? I didn't know you could get panthers as well.
I mean, at some point in time, I heard, like, I'm talking like 15 years ago, there were even like the Malagasy giants out there, but I think they've been all collected at this point. Maybe there's a few left that I don't
know. I'm also the guy that didn't know there was freaking rainbow boas in South Florida too. Like I had no idea that they.
I pretty much have come to the conclusion that everything is in Florida now. It's just a matter of times before we figure out that it's there. But I think, like, if someone tomorrow says we found a Komodo dragon in a ditch in Miami, I'm going to be like, yeah, that checks out.
Yeah. There's just a herpetofaunal wormhole.
That's all over
Florida.
To your point, 2 years ago, I found out that now in the canals of Miami, there's Sicilians. And it's not a one-off thing. Like, they're now, like, filled with Sicilians in some places. I put up a friend of mine showed me how to do this technique where if you put a minnow trap with a Vienna sausages in there, you leave it for like an hour, you'll pick it up and it's full of Sicilians.
It's full of longer, slimy sausages.
Exactly. Well, like you know how hard it is
to find a sausage machine.
If you're targeting them, you know how hard it is to find a Sicilian in the tropics.
Long, very difficult.
Like unless you get lucky during a rainstorm, like.
Yeah.
Hard, but in Miami, like if you go to the right spot, you'll get them guaranteed.
I'm kind of curious because there's not really that big of a pet market demand for them. I wonder if it's more similar to snakehead, but kind of like the snakeheads with more like a exotic food market.
This specific one, which is called the in the aquarium trade, it's known as the rubber eel. Scientifically, it's Typholnectes natans, I think is the name. That one is an aquatic Sicilian, so that one. The suspicion is that it did come from the pet trade. Okay. Because those ones, like, you don't need to keep them in a terrarium. You can keep them in an aquarium. Like, they live in water.
Okay. Okay. So those, that makes those, a bit more sense.
I don't know if people eat them. I mean, I have no idea about that, but
I wouldn't surprise me. Tasty, man. I can't imagine.
And that's probably all stringy and rubbery.
The amount of animals you would think that wouldn't be good to eat, but people eat them regularly. Like, I wouldn't be surprised at this point.
I mean, nobody's surprised at the fact that people eat iguanas. I mean, in Panama, you eat them. All of Central America, Latin America, you've had them. They are delicious.
To be fair, in Florida, where they're invasive, you're encouraged to hunt.
Yes, you are.
So I would rather not let the meat go to waste.
Yeah. Now how you procure said iguana, I'm not really in accordance with everyone that does it, especially the YouTubers that do it. But
it's the methodology that I don't agree with, even if the result is good. I mean, especially the way some of them do it, but it's good, man. If you prepare it well, like,
oh, yeah.
I'm not gonna lie, it's very tasty.
Yeah.
Okay, if you want to cut in, Nate, I had one more question about Florida. What about pine snakes? What has been your luck with those?
One. And
better than mine.
And I technically didn't find it myself. A friend of mine saw it on his property and said, come over. There's one right here. So
that is awesome.
That's a good friend. That is a good friend.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You guys might know him. His name is Michael Dye.
Yeah, I know. I know the name.
He's got a channel on YouTube. Yeah, yeah. Really good guy. So
he's a good hunter. He's a cool guy.
He knew I was after them, so he's just like, dude, I saw one. I'm like, I'll be right over.
Is that your only Pituophis you've seen in the wild?
Yeah, yeah, just that one. Yeah, that's all right,
brother. Well, I opened the invitation for you to come up to the Midwest, and we'll find plenty of bull snake.
Dude, I would absolutely love to go at some point, because I actually have, even though I lived for that many years in Florida, I barely explored most of the United States. Like, the furthest west I ever went was New Orleans to visit another friend of mine, Zachary Gray, from Life's Wild Adventures. But so I've only gone west to Louisiana, and then north to Georgia, North Carolina, and then Pennsylvania, where the Wildlife Brothers are.
But, oh man, you're a Southern boy. You never escaped the South.
No, I never escaped the South or the East,
Pennsylvania.
But, or like the South and the East. Like that's the only part. And I didn't even, outside of Florida, I barely went. So
yeah,
I really need to explore the West and the North of the states. I just never really got a chance. So yeah. When I'm back there, I'll let you know for sure.
I was gonna say, what are your plans for June?
June, we'll see where I'm at with June. It's still TBD, but where are you guys gonna be in June?
I'm gonna be at least a weekend in the Houston area for Croc Fest. They're gonna be doing a little fundraiser for Temistema. Well,
nice.
Probably trying to do a little herping, a little road cruising down in the Houston area.
Nice.
I might free up some time and join Nate, so we'll see. We'll probably be there.
Nice.
Do some
nice,
Texas tripping.
Nice. Yeah, I've always wanted to go to Texas, so
yeah. Well, to be fair, Houston is kind of like the westernmost extension of Southeast, like herpetofauna and stuff like that. You have to get a bit west of Houston where you start getting the more Texas-y stuff. So I think you can't actually find like Western Diamondbacks that far east. I've heard of people, I won't say locations, I won't say names, I have heard of people finding Western Diamondbacks like on the Gulf Coast in kind of the greater Houston area. So
okay,
I can see that. That's not terribly surprising. I can see that. They're so abundant.
I'll take out Western anywhere. I mean, I've gone Eastern at this point. So Western would be a nice compliment, I guess.
That is a nice compliment, but man, Eastern is like a great way to start off when it comes to the crux.
Oh yeah, Eastern. I've gotten. I think I got three in total when I was in three or four when I was in Florida.
Yeah.
But that one also took me a little bit of time to get. The first one I got was the biggest one of the bunch, and that one was also almost as big as the Bushmaster.
Oh wow!
That boy was very interesting, and I would say it's the closest thing in terms of texture to a Bushmaster. Like this, it had very big scales as well. So
okay,
sure.
I mean, did the Bushmaster have keel scales, or do they have smooth scales?
So
it was similar to like to beta lizards, right?
Yeah, okay, like so I wouldn't exactly call them keel, because it was more like like if you look at them very closely, like they're round instead of like sort of like.
So they're more like a raised bump.
Yeah, to the point where like there's they almost have like a ridge running down their spine.
Like okay, yeah, like, I know about the ridge, the twin ridges down the spine.
Yeah, but... yeah, like the Diamondback doesn't have that.
Yeah,
the Diamondback just got the round shape. Like the Bushmaster, like the scales really do feel like a beaded lizard.
It's more like maybe pebbly.
Yeah, like pebbly. Like it was very like both the Fertilance and the Bushmaster. The first time I touched both of them, like caught me off guard a little bit with the texture. I'm like, okay, this is gonna take a little bit to get used to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very cool.
Get
something, Nate.
Let me check the chat real quick.
Sure, go for it.
Yeah. Oh, well, while Emilio's...
Nope, I'm back.
Oh, okay. That was quick. I was going to say, got a quick update. This weekend, the Saturday, I went to town to the local library. My local library has this Friends of the Library thing where basically they have old books they're looking to get rid of. And you basically just donate whatever amount you want to give, and you get basically whatever books you want. So I managed to pick up a couple of Hurt books while I was there. So got okay. Mark O'Shea's Bows of Pythons in the World, Lizard Care for A to Z, and Salamanders of North America. I don't have it on me. I should have brought them with me. But I also picked up another book called Twilight of the Mammoths, which was about the Anthropocene extinction, how we could learn from that for modern conservation and rewilding and stuff like that. So,
yeah, I would say the takeaway is stop trying to bring back the mammoths. They don't need to come back.
But it'd be kind of cool. You got to admit. It'd just be kind of cool. Good luck getting the genetic material from those. But.
They're out there, Nate. They're out there. Have faith.
Just find some random untouched forest on New Caledonia. It's like the Hidden Valley in New Caledonia.
Yep, and they just got thylacine out there. But you mentioned boas and pythons right now, right?
Yeah.
So I think now is a good time to introduce that topic as well, because earlier I mentioned that the second most common snake I find here on the ranch is the cat-eyed snake, but actually the most common snake I see, which is I see at around one per day, is the boa constrictor, there's also taxonomic debate as to which species we have. Some say it's imperator, which is the same one as Central America. Some say it's constrictor, which is the same one we have on the east of Ecuador, but right here it's kind of like a gray zone, but whatever they are, they're boas.
Well, I mean, I guess how do their, I guess, head morphology look? Is it kind of long?
So I can show you. Hang on.
Please. Perfect.
This is what I got today. Yeah.
Wow.
So I still got to relocate him, but I've been catching like one a day lately. And what's cool is that their patterns are significantly different enough to where I can sometimes recognize individuals. Like, I'm pretty sure I caught this guy. I have to like reference the photo like per se, but like I feel like I caught this guy last year already.
Yeah, boa stud book.
Good. Yeah, yeah. I take pictures of all the ones I catch, but like this one, there's one that I don't know if I sent you the photo, but there's one that I caught that I've caught like most years I've come here that it's very dark in color. Like it's a very dark snake, like even compared to this boa, but yeah, like you start kind of recognizing them individually. And like, it's interesting, like, oh, I found you here last year and now you're all on this side of the property. Like, damn, what have you been up to?
Sure. Sure. I can relate with my milk snakes. That's awesome.
The head there.
I mean, just off the bat, it looks imperator to me. Oh, actually no, that head helps a bit.
They are very bitey, so that's why I'm holding.
I have an imperator in the cage right behind me. So you want me to get it out for comparison?
So the argument I hear most often is the fact that like their tails are dark instead of red.
Yeah.
I think that's
it's
what
the I'm tails, thinking. The tails and the head morphology. Like right off the bat, to me, it screams Imperator. But then again, if you're saying you're in an integration zone, I mean,
yeah, you know, I mean, I've seen like the taxonomy change over the years. Where like at one point they were called like boa constrictor longicauda or something like that, but then that got eliminated. Then they were boa constrictor Imperator. Then they're boa constrictor. You know, nothing. Then they're just boa Imperator. Like I've seen names thrown around where I honestly don't really mind what the name is. I just
they're it's boa. A boa.
Yeah,
it's a boa. Or is there what's a colloquial name you guys call them, like Mazacuata or
so Vibra, what's funny is the name we give them here is Mata Caballo, which means horse killer, even though they do know such thing, let me be clear. But there's the myth here that what they'll do is that they'll go at night, go around to horses and wrap around their necks and choke them to death. They do not do that, but the name just kind of stuck. So we have Mata Caballo out here.
You know, the lore that snakes have are some of the most fanciful in all the animal kingdom. And I tell you what, it's hilarious.
Okay, so
this is an Imperator, probably a Nicaraguan locale.
Man, already right off the bat, they look quite different pattern-wise.
Oh, pattern-wise, dude, like I was mentioning, like even the ones here, they look completely different. Like maybe I can pull it up on my phone just to show you real quick, because it'll be very apparent.
Still, both beautiful snakes. That's a pretty feisty one, Nate.
Yeah.
This one, if I were to let him go, he'd be doing the same thing.
Oh, I believe it. I believe it.
Yeah.
Even though there's a reason the former owners of this one named him Hades. So
I'm just the one over here.
A picture showing there on the screen, but like this is a very black one. This one. This one I found right before this one. Like this one was caught 2 days ago. In the same location, like you see that their patterns are super variable.
That's here, very different. It's a very dark boa.
Yeah. So I've seen one in Panama that looks more like this one than that one.
Sure.
So yeah, it's very hard to.
I mean, boas are quite variable as well. So
yeah, they're not quite eyelash viper variable, but they're really, it's really easy to tell the individuals apart after some time.
Yeah.
Whereas with like other snakes, like they all look like clones of them of each other. Like you can't tell them apart. Like try to tell a green snake from another one. Like good luck with that. Tough. Yeah.
Dang.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, you just to casually find a boa a day on your property, that's awesome, dude.
Yeah, I mean the cheat code is that you gotta look around the chicken coops.
Oh yeah.
they love the chicken coops. They're basically
gee, I wonder why.
They're our equivalent to the rat snakes.
Yes.
Like they're essentially how you would target a rat snake in the States, that's how you find boas here. You'll find them like up in the roof of the chicken coops. And yes, it has happened where they've taken chickens or chicks, but it's rare. Mostly they're after the rats. So what I like to do is that like when there's ever an area that we're finding a lot of rats, I'll release a boa. And that usually solves the problem for a fair amount of time, like to the point where I did that last week at one of the holding areas for cows we have out here. There was like a pipe that had like a bunch of rats living in it. I sent a boa about this size down it. And dude, at the other end, like four rats shot out. Last night when I went to go check on the pipe, the snake is still in there. Rats are nowhere to be seen.
That's awesome. So free vermin control at your disposal.
That's also a way that I try to get people both here and elsewhere to not kill them. I'm like, you don't really have to kill them because they're not only not a threat, they can actually help you.
Some, rotoneras, you know, rat eaters.
Ratoneras. Yeah, there's a couple snakes that are actually called ratoneras in Latin America.
There's a lot of snakes. It's a lot of snakes.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Like, more convenient to have them around.
It's funny how. No, go on.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say it's funny how every rat snake like has its carbon copy all around the world, whether it's boa or carpet python, or, you know, what have you.
I would argue that in Australia, it's more like the brown snake that's the rat snake equivalent than carpets.
Really?
I can see an argument being made for it.
They're not. I mean, I can see when it comes to vermin control and like having a rat appetite, but
and also their metabolism, movement, and overall like body shape.
I'll tell you what. I wouldn't be holding a brown snake the way I'm holding this boa. I would hold a rat snake like that, no problem. I wouldn't hold a brown snake though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no. Brown snakes, those are scary. Unless you hold them by the middle of the body, that way they can't turn around on you.
Ooh, that's a pretty good idea. Let's give it a shot. Down there.
You know, I wanted to touch on just a few more things in Panama. So, have you seen other venomous or vipers specifically? Or
so in Panama, the ones I've seen so far have been the ones I've mentioned, which is eyelash, equis, bushmaster.
What about mano de pierna?
I have seen one more. I haven't seen mano de pierna. That's one another very high up on the list. They're not very common in Panama, though. That's the issue with them. Like, I'd have to really grind for them. But the other one that I've seen is the hognose viper.
Porthidium. Yes. Porthidium.
Yeah, that's the other one. I almost forgot that one. But Porthidium is the other one that I've seen. I think they're like the copperhead equivalent. That's basically how I can describe them, because at least the species I found, which is the Porthidium landsberg, it doesn't really like the jungle that much. Like, it prefers like more like grassland savanna areas, like more dry flat zones, rather than like being up in the mountains like the other one that I haven't seen yet, which is Porthidium nasutum. That one is very much a wet jungle, like tropical rainforest snake. But landsbergi, that one, like, you'll just be out and you'll just see like a little coiled penny on the ground. And it's like, oh, that's a viper. So
yeah, I mean, give a description. They're not big snakes at all.
No. They're very small. Like, they can grow like max like 50 centimeters, I think, 60, something like that. The one I found was small too. It was like 20 centimeters. Like, it was a small one. But that was one that I was after for a little bit. And when I finally saw one, I'm like, oh, great.
And, you know, some have a bigger rostral projection than others. Like, what was the species? Nasathum? Like, that one has
That one has more than this one. This one barely had it. This one barely had any. I mean, you could tell it was a Porthidium, but like, it wasn't the most. I think I forgot which one is the one in Costa Rica that has like the really pointed one. Or maybe it's Mexico. Yeah. One of them has like a very pointed stout.
The one in Mexico I found is Dunny. I don't know if there's multiple species in Mexico.
Dunny, yeah.
That's the one I found.
That one, is it very pointy?
It's okay, prominent.
That might be the one I'm thinking about, yeah.
Yeah. No, they're cool. They're cool vipers for sure, man.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to look for the other one as well at some point, but at least I found one of them. Speaking of the Darien that I mentioned earlier, like the other Bushmaster that I still need to find in Panama is the Chicoan one. So now that I found the Central American one, which is La Quesis stenophorus, there's not much as much pressure to find the other one as there would have been before, but I still want that other one too. So
black cap Bushmaster.
Yeah, blackhead, like a melanocephala. Blackhead, is that it?
That one's melanocephala, and that one, like, there's a debate where is it endemic to Costa Rica or not? Like, if you go to Costa Rica, they'll say yes. If you go to Panama, they'll be like, nah, I've seen one here. So like, there might be some in Panama, but like right at the border with Costa Rica, we're talking like around the Boquete, Chiriqui Alto, Volcán Barú, like that Cerro Punta area.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not where I'm going mostly. So I don't think.
That's a province where you were alluding to earlier, to where, you know, it's not your typical neotropical humid, wet rainforest type. It's cool and it's mountainous.
It is very humid though. It is very humid, but it's very similar to the cloud forest here in a lot of ways. But it has been greatly developed. Like, there's a lot of grassland around now where the habitat loss caused that harlequin toad to go extinct along with the kidra.
I mean, it's a great spot for expats. That's kind of one of the reasons why it's
being it is. But it's also very icy. Like I mentioned, there's only one road to get there.
Yeah.
Like an 8-hour drive from the capital. So I've only been there once, and it just so happened that there was a very severe thunderstorm, so I didn't get to do anything. But that's one place I definitely want to go back to soon, because there is a bunch of species over there that pretty much are unique in terms of like Panamanian species.
I mean, I think of what it was, Cirrhophion, like that one.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
General of vipers.
Yeah, Cirrhophidian Society. Yeah, the Montane. Mm-hmm. And then you got the other Botrachus, the Lateralis, and the Nigrovirids. Yeah. Mano de Piedra, that's also a good spot for them, apparently.
Yeah, we could probably chat off air. You probably know some ecologists, some areas. And maybe,
For sure. Yeah, yeah. And hey, you know, if you guys are down to go to the Darien at some point, you know, that's the one place I don't want to go alone. So.
Need some muscle to back you up.
That would come very much in handy.
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, we're starting to wrap it up, but I'm just curious, in all of your travels and whatnot, when it comes to networking, would you say that's one takeaway, I guess, skill that you've developed in terms of just learning about different areas and trying to find, you know, different fauna, flora?
100%. Like there's no question about it. Of course, you always want to try to network with like people within the scientific community or within the herping community. Like that's very useful. But the first thing I do when I go to any place is just talk to local people, like non-wildlife people at all, because they're always going to be the ones that know the most about the area.
Mm-hmm.
Like, getting to network with people like there, like sure, you have to be able to filter a lot of things. Like they'll tell you a lot of nonsense, but like you do learn things that you won't find from anyone else. Like networking with local people for me is always like number one on the priority list when it comes to like, okay, what do we need to do before we start looking for the target animal?
Yeah, that was a good takeaway skill for sure.
So when you go to Panama, like, dude, we're I'm sure you know a lot of people there too as well, but like, we're gonna meet some characters for sure.
I mean, I'm curious about this Bejuquilla spot. I love Bejuquillas. They're awesome.
Oh, dude, I'm telling you, once we go there, it's a spot you've probably been to already. Like if you go there, I think you know where it is. But like, if we go to that spot, we'll get some for sure.
Also, for reference, Bejuquillas are the vine snakes. That's just a colloquial term. I'm tossing out there. I mean, Nate, did you have any other points to touch on before we wrap up?
Well, if we don't have any other questions, we could always do our little closer, which is, you know, our little tradition of asking guests what's the one country or habitat they want to go herping in the most that they haven't been to. No.
Haven't.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's a very tough question, but just because I have barely been to the old world at all at any point. So I want to pick something that's not on the list just to mix things up. So obviously stuff like Australia and Madagascar are all very common choices. Also Southeast Asia, those are great. South America, I mean, I live here. So I'll pick up a little bit and say Spain.
Okay, you're in Brian's camp then.
I'm going to say Spain. Spain, I think, in terms of Europe, is the number one country I want to go to. Obviously, the language, knowing the language helps a lot. And it's a little bit of a cheat, but the cool thing about Spain is that you have quick access to Morocco. So you can easily pop over to the North African desert, get some stuff there, and then go back to Europe. Like,
you know, that's one thing I never really thought about. I was too focused.
That's why I'm saying Spain, but it's kind of like mixed in there. Because Spain itself also has a lot of really cool things. Like the chameleons make it up to Spain. They have a lot of cool like snakes and salamanders. But also like you got stuff like the Iberian lynx, the European brown bear, the Wells catfish, like non-herp stuff is also really cool. So I'm going to say like that Spain-Morocco combo just to not repeat anything that's already on the list.
Yeah, I have heard that Morocco is a pretty good, great place to go herping in. And out of all the places in the sort of Middle Eastern Arabic world, it might be one of the safer ones to go to as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's why I said Spain. And Spain for itself for sure is a target, but like, mixing in with Morocco, that's what makes it so high on the list for me, because like it's probably the easiest way for me to break into Africa at some point.
So the hop, skip, and jump across the Strait of Gibraltar.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. I mean, you could get your desert black cobra. I think Varanus gris gets.
What's the sand viper that they have over there as well? One of the horned ones, I think.
Cerastes, one of the Cerastes.
Just talking to Phil Wolf, he'll know.
Yeah. They've also got some desert monitors out there. I think they have a lot of cool stuff that I would want from that desert. So like Spain, Morocco, I think would be a really good combo.
All right.
Great choice. Yeah. I guess one more thing before we wrap up. I know you have a YouTube channel. It's obviously your name, but just shout it out. Yep. Animal Encounters.
Animal Encounters on YouTube as well as on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
You guys want to check it out?
Yeah, I would highly recommend the people who watch it that you do check it out.
Thank you very much. Nate and Brian, it was a pleasure to speak with you guys. And for sure, if you guys ever want to, as I mentioned, if you guys want to come to Ecuador or Panama, door's always open.
We might talk about on the after show, which you guys will not be able to see.
No Patreon that they can hop on and then
I honestly not enough viewers, and I don't make enough content to justify Patreon. So
I'm just
beg for money. So
gotcha. Right, but yeah, thank you guys so much for having me.
All right.
Oh, it's our pleasure, dude. Bad.